You are listening to Faith is Brewing, a Magic the Gathering podcast for the Spike Rogue. Each week, we design new decks for tournament play. We put our creations to the test and share our findings on the air. This week on the Roundup, we speculate wildly about forthcoming changes in Monday's Banned and Restricted announcement. Can the companion mechanic be saved? After that, on the flashback, new takes on Vaedrock, Apex of Thunder, in Modern and Pioneer. All of that and more is coming up on this edition of Faithless Brewing. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Welcome to episode 56 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. I am David Robertson. I have making my glorious return from a partially disease-oriented week-long break here. I am joined, as always, by my guy on the left coast, Damon Alexander. Damon, what's up?
Hey, we have some nice weather in Seattle. My companion cards just came in the mail, no joke. So you had a good outcome of your test, I guess?
Yeah, so we had no spread of coronavirus, either from the person in the mailroom or the person from one of the pharma labs. So everybody else tested negative, and they're, you know, whatever, resting comfortably. Nobody's life is at risk. Also, both of my parents tested positive last week. They had been sick already for like 10 or 11 days before they kind of got bullied by us kids into getting tested. And they are both recovering slowly, so both personally and professionally, it was kind of a stressful week last week, but it sounds like everyone's going to be A-okay. But just a reminder to everybody out there, the way people are talking about this, we have not defeated this virus. It is still certainly out of control. So, you know, please continue to take precautions. Think about the old, the infirm, the people who are less well off than you are when you're making decisions. So before we get too morose about the discussion about the pandemic, let's bring in the CEO of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. He is Dan Schriever. Dan, what's going on?
Hey, welcome back, David. Yeah, I don't really know what to say to that about your parents. I mean, that's tough. I hope they're doing well.
Yeah, I talked to them. They talked for like an hour tonight, and it's definitely, that's longer than they've been able to chat for before. Neither of them has any problem breathing or any serious fever anymore. So just resting at home, drinking a lot of fluids and eating a lot of soup, puttering around outside without exerting themselves at all. The American retirement made manifest, I guess.
Yeah. So I'm out here on the East Coast, and Damon is usually our weatherman checking in on the Seattle weather. It's been gorgeous out here in Connecticut. I try to get outside for like a walk in the park, or there's some streets that my town has blocked off for pedestrians to use, more spaced out. And it just feels like a change. Like, it feels like summer is here. And now I'm just wondering what's going to happen. You see like a lot of people out in the streets. People are restless. And I think it's like you're saying, like there's this, people are bored of the coronavirus, just ready to get back to whatever that is, magic or life or something like that. You know, I don't know if this is not the right time for that.
I think there's a famous saying that like a pilot is the most dangerous after like 200 hours flight time, because they've flown enough that they like think that they know what they're doing, but they don't actually have enough experience to deal with any of the major problems. And I feel like that is a pretty accurate reflection of where we are with the coronavirus. We're in like inning three, and all these people who are not epidemiologists or virologists are like, oh man, we finally made it like through the seventh inning stretch. We just got to do a little bit more and we're ready to go here. And I think we're like Captain Sully without the 50 years of experience. And we're going to have to land in the fucking Hudson.
That movie did not get made.
Yeah, I think the beginning pilots are safer because they just are so attentive and alert and reading their manuals and stuff. And yeah, definitely the U.S. was very on top of our initial response, was super superb, very conservative. Analogy holds perfectly across the whole spectrum.
Well, that's all very depressing. So let's get on to less depressing news, which is to give a shout out to our Patreon. We have got some spectacular art up all over the place. Daniel, let's give a shout out to the artist. As usual, we're big fans.
Yeah, we have our new playmat art from Ev Davis, who is at Art of Whistler on Twitter. He's been doing just an awesome job. Ev also did our social banner, which you can find on our Twitter feed as well. That's the Niv-Mizzet Cafe, the Faithless Brewing Cafe. And the playmat is just a spectacular scene. Much more epic in feel, I think. It's like a grand vista. rooftop cafe where Niv-Mizzet is enjoying his morning brew over the Kaladesh sunrise. So those are all things that we're going to get out there on some merch. Those are benefits you can receive as one of the perks of joining our Patreon. You also get access to our Discord. You get our extended show notes. Ask us listener questions, that kind of thing. We'd love to have you there. Patreon.com/faithlessbrewing is the place where you can sign up if you are so inclined.
Definitely. If you want to drop sweet gifts in the Discord about Simpsons, we've got some absolute bangers being dropped every other day in there. So entertainment's for young and old.
We get the first look at Matt Asimbl's finest work.
Exactly.
He had a great one today from, what was that episode from The Simpsons, where it was Bob Dole and Bill Clinton who had been body snatched by aliens?
I believe it's one of the Halloween specials. I think it's like the fourth or fifth one.
Oh, right. So he had redone this scene as like alien Bob Dole saying, "Companions for all." And everyone says, "Boo, boo." Okay, companions for nobody. And this everyone says, "Boo, boo." Oh, okay, how about this? Companions for some and secret lair drops for others. That's kind of where we're at right now with Magic.
Yeah, peace in our time.
Yeah, the EDH community, which was normally so fun, happy-go-lucky, compared to us, competitive constructed format players, they had a bit of a tiff over some of the pricing on the double masters and secret lairs. Interesting to see that not all is happy in that world either.
Yeah, I forgot about double masters. That feels like months ago. Jeez. That was a product from, 4 days ago? And I'm already...
Yeah.
Just to make sure I got that correct, double masters is a reprint set that is not going to affect legality in any formats, right? So that's not relevant for us.
Correct.
Unless you like playing limited formats, I guess.
Which we do.
And their track record with these Masters limited sets is high to quite high. I mean, especially in the last couple of years, those have been the highlights of the year, as maybe some of their constructed designs have been more miss than hit.
Yeah. The biggest tragedy of this coronavirus is not being able to play Mystery Booster at GPs. I mean, among other tragic aspects.
The 100,000 dead is number two, and then it's like...
Sure.
I think Double Masters has the possibility of being as fun as Mystery Booster, because Mystery Booster, due to the collation, had like two rare slots. I mean, it wasn't quite rarity, but it was like two exciting slots per pack, plus the playtest card. So like just having like stacked packs made it like pretty cool as a format. So hopefully Double Masters will capture some of that.
Well, we'd expect it to be twice as good as Single Master, so we'll have to get out our abacus and make sure that all the numbers add up there. So on to the big news of the day, which is that the Magic the Gathering at Wizards_Magic Twitter feed announced an announcement, the promise ring, the promise to be promised. On Monday, the 1st of June, there will be an update to the banned and restricted list impacting the standard and historic formats that will also address the companion mechanic. Now, obviously, it does not say in what way it will address the companion mechanic. You could, if you wanted to be a literalist, say that this announcement could just say that they're not going to change the companion mechanic. But I think the default understanding of this is that there will be some cards banned in both the historic and standard format. And then in addition to that, the way that the companion mechanic functions will be altered across all competitive formats.
This sentence is so hard to parse. There will be an update to the ban and restriction list impacting the standard and historic formats that will also address the companion mechanic. If you ban companions in modern, that clearly is not just impacting standard and historic. So, like, how exactly does this parse?
Well, I'm thinking those are two separate statements that are not separated correctly by a semicolon. I'm reading that there will be a ban in standard and ban in historic. So at least one card will be banned in each of those formats. In addition to that, there will be some statement made on the companion mechanic.
Yeah, I think if you read it as is, it actually implies that they will not touch companion in other formats. It says there will be an update impacting standard and historic that will also address companion. So that would be two updates. But I think we're all assuming that that's not what they mean. They actually do think there will be two updates. One is some sort of BNR, and two is companion changes.
Well, I think they're calling the BNR as a totality a single item, and within that BNR update, it can include multiple things.
And there was a question posed to Mark Rosewater, I think, a week or two ago. The questioner had asked, is it possible that you would change companion only in certain formats and let the mechanic work as normal in other formats? And he said no. He said, if we do any kind of change, it's going to affect all formats. Now, that's Mark Rosewater. I assume his word is good. So if there is any change, I think it will impact Modern, Pioneer, everything else.
I do think it's a shame. They could have just conspiracied it, right? Like, conspiracy has specific verbiage that says conspiracy as a mechanic does not exist outside limited. That is a path they could have chosen for companion.
Yeah, so they will have the counseled it.
Exactly.
So we want to dive into this a little bit more. I think this episode should come out before the actual change is posted on Monday, so you'll get a chance to listen to us speculate wildly and baselessly, and then on Monday you can laugh at us as it turns out that we were wildly, wildly off base. But I think that in terms of sort of tackling what we expect from this BNR, there's kind of three separate questions. The first one is, like, should there be a change to the companion? What is going on with the metagame right now? Is there a companion problem? Secondly, we could say what should or could be done to change the mechanic. And then third, we can talk a little bit about what cards might be additionally banned or unbanned in Standard and Historic. We did solicit the fine folks in our Discord to pose some questions to help us think through these possibilities. So right off the bat, I want to start with a question from Bin395, who asks, are companions the problem, or is it just Luris and Urion that are the problem?
I mean, a companion not listed in that question is already banned, so that's, I mean, it's tautologically obvious. We don't need to discuss it anymore.
I think there is a valid question lurking here.
What about this ban card? Was that a problem? I don't know, man. It's banned.
It's true. Zerda has been shown the door already in Legacy. Yeah. It does feel like there are, in theory, companions that you could print that would not be massive problems like the current generation of companions are. I personally feel like the mechanic is just too tricky to do right. But you could argue that cards like Umori or Karuga or possibly Giganta maybe could have a home, or maybe if they're just like a little bit worse.
Well, that kind of ties into the question about the mechanic itself, right? So if you think the mechanic is fundamentally flawed, then you have to alter the mechanic. That's obviously what Wizards decided. They don't agree that these two specifically, obviously those are very powerful and they're seeing a lot of consistent play. But the other thing you could do is, like what they tried to do, their first banning was to just look at specific formats like Vintage and say, okay, Luris' specific interaction is too powerful with the commonly played cards, and so we have to ban it. It'll be interesting to see if they revisit those decisions depending on the alterations they make to the companion mechanic itself.
Yeah, I do think that it's important to just sort of pause and take the pulse of the metagame as we understand it, if nothing else, just for a time capsule for posterity. So this is, what is today? This is May 27th. There's been a great series of posts on the Modern subreddit from someone named KT Kenshinks, who used to be a writer on Modern Nexus and has since started a blog called MTG Modern Metrics, where they have like these really in-depth data-driven posts every week or so, looking at just the totality of the metagame and trying to analyze trends. So definitely recommend that blog, and I'll put a link to this article in the website. But the gist of it is that companion saturation is at about 70% right now in Modern among published lists, and that includes 5-0s, high tournament finishes, all that kind of stuff. Luris herself is at 46.3% overall, and among like the meta decks, it's at 49.6%, with Urion, Giganta, and Obosh all running strong behind Luris. So, yes, we are definitely in the companion metagame right now. You could make the case that if we just accept that as a fact of life, the metagame is fairly diverse. This article also had a pretty nice metagame breakdown in terms of archetypes, where you see aggro at about 32%, mid-range at 23.6%, combo at 15.8%, big mana 15.8%, control at 11%, and tempo bringing up the rear at 1%. So that's all the main strategies represented. But when you look more closely and you see that they're all companion versions of those strategies, it does make you wonder.
I mean, I don't think this data is as meaningful as people seem to make it out to be. The way to think about companions is not just because a deck has a companion, it is making use of the companion mechanic. Like, Tron is basically just playing Giganta because it can. Same with Niv-Mizzet, and it's making, like, a few sacrifices. But it's basically the same deck that's always existed. And then it's making other choices to reflect the metagame. Whereas the Luris decks are just straight up built around Luris. They're playing four Bauble specifically because of Luris. They're playing Seal of Fire specifically because of Luris. So I think it's a little unfair to say, oh, it's a companion metagame, and this is coming from someone who hates companions. If it's a deck like Tron that just happens to be playing Giganta, that is, I think, what we were hoping would be more how this mechanic was used, as opposed to just building a deck around Urion or Luris specifically. Or in the case of Zerda in Legacy.
But didn't we just have that question? Is it just Luris and Urion that are the problems? And you said, no, it's clearly all companions are a problem. And now you're saying it's just Luris and Urion.
No, Zerda is banned. I literally, there's one fact here, but there's no opinion. Zerda is banned. So we can't just say that those two are the problem.
Wait, so David, you're saying that you like companions that you don't really build around, and you don't like companions that you do build around?
I'm just saying those should not be just grouped together. I'm saying you can dislike the mechanic a lot, as I do, and I don't think it's fair to say that it's a companion metagame if Tron exists. Because what Tron is doing is not exploiting the companion. It's exploiting the fact that it goes over the top of Luristex, and it happens to play a companion while it does that for free, more or less. That's a little different than what the Luristex are doing. They can both be bad. They're just, it's not the same thing. Those should not be compared like one to one. Let's say you did this. Let's say you banned, let's say you thought that you had to keep the companion mechanic and you banned Mishra's Bauble, and then Lurus decks just became weaker. So they became less of the format. That would probably mean that Obosh decks would be more common. So the Ponza decks would be more common. So you'd see less quote unquote companions from the Tron player, but it's just because there's less Tron because the matchups that it exploits are gone. So that has nothing to do with the companion mechanic per se.
I mean, so I have two thoughts. One is that you could call these Luris decks different decks all you want. You can say that like Luris, Grixis Control is playing Archmage's Charm. They're a totally different deck than Red Black Prowess. They play kind of the same. They play four Sprite Dragon. They play four Delver. They put a fast clock on you. Sprite Dragon basically has upgraded Prowess, if anything. And the matchups feel quite similar. Every Luris deck, besides maybe Devoted Druid, that feels a little bit different, but kind of miserable in a very different way. Maybe even more miserable with like the freaking Giver of Runes. You like finally, you know, Giver of Runes with Luris is a nightmare. I'll just say that much. So it's not actually that diverse in terms of how the games play out, even though like the cards are a little bit different. And then just going into these queues, like right now, when I play Modern, I go to a game, like your opponent reveals pre-game, they reveal a companion or not. If they don't have a companion, one of three things is happening. One is they are playing Ad Nauseam. Two is they're playing Amulet Titan. Or three is they're as crazy as we are when we play non-companion decks, which is quite crazy. Sometimes people play Eldrazi Tron and like I teach them a lesson as soon as I play my companion because they just go, it's a huge edge that I didn't used to have over Eldrazi Tron.
Yeah, so briefly on the Pioneer format, we don't have the same statistics that I just mentioned in Modern. But if you just go to the metagame page on Goldfish, you pretty much get a similar picture. All the top decks seem to feature either Luris, Urien, or Gyruda. So think of like Luris Burn, Luris Ensoul Artifact, Luris Rally the Ancestors, Luris Ram Auras. On the Urien camp, there's Blue-White Control, there's Niv-Mizzet, Jeskai, Luka, Super Friends, a port directly from Standard into Pioneer has sort of taken a foothold there. The only decks that don't really have companions are some Demir Inverter decks are playing Urien, some are not, some are just playing 60-card Inverter. Lotus Breach mostly does not have a companion, although some are deciding to play Luris anyway and give up on Vizier of Tumbling Sands. But beyond that, it seems like the best decks in Pioneer are also identifying these powerful companions as the way to go.
Yeah, I mean, the fundamental question is, okay, look, it's not these days, especially with the modern card design, every new set is going to be very powerful. We talked about this right before Ikoria came out. The Theros set basically built the Tier 1 stage in Pioneer. It built all of the decks from nothing. None of those decks existed before, and then there were three tier one decks from there. So if that's something that you're willing to accept, then the companion is not that dissimilar. It basically built a series of the tier one decks. What it does do is exclude, like Damon is saying, any other mid-range build, any other aggro build. You cannot do anything that's trying to play an actual game of Magic beyond turn four if you are not going to play a companion. So what that means and what it's meant in Modern and what it meant in Legacy and Vintage is that it restricted an entire class of cards in all of Magic's history to be cards that specifically meet the requirements of the three or four or five most powerful companions. If that's acceptable to you, then the companion mechanic is fine, regardless of how powerful each individual companion is. If you want the entire breadth of Magic cards to be played that don't meet those conditions from companions, then you have to think about altering the mechanic fundamentally, because you just can't play a fair deck competitively that's trying to play beyond turn four. By turn five, you functionally have lost the game.
Yeah.
So that's why the non-companion decks are all combo decks. They basically don't care about the material that's being gained or lost. Urien draws five cards, I kill you with Ad Nauseam. Urien draws five cards, I kill you with Valakut. Luris is, you know, rebuying a bunch of 2/1 creatures and 1/2 creatures. I, you know, Lotus Breach you out. Those are the interactions. So if you're willing to live with that forever, because you have to print a bunch more companions, you have to either print a bunch of cards that meet the guise of these companions, or you basically have a set metagame forever.
Yeah, like in modern, it feels like basically modern used to have six-ish, you know, tier one decks at a given time, and then a broad set of tier 1.5 to tier two decks, depending on how you define those labels. And right now, it feels like you either are playing one of these top decks, and that's tier one, possibly tier zero, or you're playing like a tier three deck. The tier one decks just have such a leg up. They have such a leg up over the decks that would have otherwise been tier two now. They just play Lurrus and they're ahead by two cards, which is just backbreaking. And so you just play these fair decks or, you know, your favorite Merfolk deck or whatever. They used to be fine and now it's bad. It's just not a good deck.
Well, you can play Lurrus Merfolk. They're playing Azorius.
True. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess if Lurrus, that's a 1-0. The card you draw off the bubble is a 2-0. So a 2-0 is a 3-1, which is basically Ancestral Recall. But that's just like the minimum you get. And then if you don't kill it right away, which is quite hard to do, they're getting more. It's weird how both these cards just lend to grindy games. Like Lurrus and Urien both promote long grindy games. Although Lurrus, because of the CMC restriction, does also allow you to play a quicker aggro game if you want to. Urien does not.
I think that's one of the things with the red-black prowess deck. You get to play this deck that's quote-unquote all in. Right, it can kill you very fast. It has, Damon can tell us, probably with personal experience, it can kill you turn three, turn four with some regularity. But you're not all in anymore because at the end of it, you get to just have this Ancestral Recall effect for free. Like, oh, I'm a little flooded or whatever. It's like, not only is it all the Horizon Canopy lands from Modern Horizons, plus Lurrus, plus all these escape cards. I mean, it's like this deck also just goes long while having the ability to kill you on turn four. So it does it all.
Yeah, it grinds super well. It can just turn into this control deck in a lot of matchups. Like, just playing, hey, I'm playing four Lightning Bolts, four Seal of Fires, four Fatal Pushes. I'm just going to kill every single creature you have. And normally a deck like this, you know, doesn't have the card advantage to keep this up. At some point, they'll run out. But Lurrus just by itself gives them such an engine so that they'll actually just have more removal than another deck that doesn't have Lurrus will have creatures. You play creatures and everything dies. Like, I'm playing some decks like, you know, play Quang Oracle. Nobody ever kills that. Lurrus decks just kill that all day long, and they don't run out of removal all game.
So given that this is the way things are, this is the state of the metagame, and we've been talking about this for several weeks now, as has everyone else, seems like something is about to change, but we do have a couple interesting questions maybe before diving into that. One question from Matt B. Matt B. asks, one of the things I actually liked about Companions was that putting cards in your deck that you wouldn't normally consider because you had to meet the requirements. So were there any aspects of the Companion era of Magic that you guys actually enjoyed? I'll note that we don't know for sure that the Companion era is over, but let's imagine that it's Tuesday and Companions have been wiped off the face of the multiverse. What will we remember fondly about the Companion era?
Some of the Companion games are actually pretty interesting, long, complex, grindy games. They remind me a lot of like these legacy blue brainstorm mirrors where everybody just has all these resources. You keep whittling your opponent down, but they keep having other like top decks. You have top decks. They thought they whittled you down. You draw a Jace. And so like a lot of these games are actually pretty interesting as far as Magic goes. If you watch some of like, you know, Canister playing Red Black Prowess, there's a lot of videos of him playing that in the challenges. Or Reduke playing the kind of a Jund build. You can find some videos on YouTube, I believe, or from also on Twitch. They're just very interesting games when he's playing these matchups. When either Pyle is playing these matchups against other like Lurrus decks, just tons of decision points. The problem is that the way these decks are is that that will be, you know, Magic forever. And the same legacy game every game gets old. You want to have some variety with your opposition.
Yeah, there's a lot of similarity to the height of Oko as well, where there's tons of decisions every turn. All these Oko decks, they were very interactive, right? Oko interacts with your creature. Oko trades a creature for permanence. When do you use these certain modes? And Lurrus gives you all these options. There's multiple cards you can play out of your graveyard. There's multiple escape cards. Do you want to try to kill them quickly? When do you play your Lurrus? It's sort of that, like, when do you bring your queen out from Bobby Fischer, which Dan and I both love. And so there is some tension, right? When are you going to try to play that Urien? Do you play into counter magic? What if I just leave two mana up forever? Is it such a blow to lose your Urien that you never want to risk it until you get desperate, then you have to play it? But, I mean, the problem is that, like Damon is saying, this happens every game, not some games, you know? So the joke, just like we always describe with these cards, like the Lotus Breach thing, it's like once you figure it out, it's like it's kind of cool for a couple weeks. But then it's like every game, and you have to do that yourself to be competitive. So it's not like there's this tension where you get to do an equally powerful thing if you choose not to play a companion. It's that if they get to resolve this, the game is over. And they all kind of read the same. Karuga, Obosh and Urien basically say, if I have three unanswered permanents and I resolve my five drop, you can only interact with counter magic, then the game basically ends. And that's just not that fun after a while.
I think for me, I agree with the premise of Matt's question that it is kind of fun from a deck building perspective to like think of, you know, how do you meet the requirement. Where it stops being fun is when that's no longer considered creative. Like, I personally have loved trying to build Karuga the Necrosage decks, and they've all failed miserably so far. Like, it's just, it's like almost, it's silly. Like, you just can't do that in modern, but I'm going to keep trying. And, you know, when it's like an underdog, when it's like, oh, hey, that actually worked, and like, it's pretty satisfying, but we just quickly move past that within days of the set going live to the point where it's like, oh, yeah, obviously you're playing these really strong companions, and that kind of just took the wind out of the sails. But I think that, like, the idea of it, I think I said this during our preview episode, that each companion offering what seems to be very, very stringent asks and deck building restrictions does make a lot of room for sort of deck building creativity, and you get to dig deep and sort of find unlikely cards to fill out the deck. So that's cool. I think that if there is some future in which companions as a sort of deck building goal still are out there as a thing you can try, that would be cool. Although if there's any weakening, I don't think that Lutri has a chance. Sorry, Damon.
Just keep Lutri.
Yeah, like, Lutri was the actual companion that functioned the way they wanted to. You had to kind of make these almost meme-ish decks. When it worked, it was super sweet. We talked about the challenge of building a Lutri and how do you pick each card. But for so many of these other decks, like, okay, Karuga is interesting in older formats because of the mana cost is an actual thing. But in Standard, I mean, basically people just played Fires and changed, like, a card. It was just like, well, that puzzle was less interesting, right? And so, like, Luris in Legacy or Vintage or even in Modern, it obviously selected a bunch of these cards for you. So I think even the Urien thing turned out to actually just be, like, add a bunch of cards that trigger when Urien resolves and, you know, a third of the cards you add to your deck are lands or more because you always want to hit five lands. And that was the end of it. We didn't, like, there's no Urien Bruise. It's just the same decks with 14 extra Mythic Rares.
Yeah, there was interesting innovation to be had, and I think it has been had. You know, like the red-black prowess deck in Modern, it wasn't figured out on day one. It took a while. People were playing the red-white decks, and then all of a sudden, it turns out Cling to Dust is like the key card in that deck, and that card came out of nowhere to me.
And specifically how, because it techs out against the other Luris decks.
It's actually just good in general. It techs out against almost every matchup. It cycles and pumps your prowess team, and then it comes back and like grinds. Like it's kind of like Uro in a sense, almost.
Yeah, I think it has been cool to sort of see some of these cards that we've always felt like they had potential. Like Cling to Dust is one of them. Seal of Fire is another one that, you know, if you had been going deep on Tarmogoyf and then Delirium in the past, you might have had that on your radar as like a thing to keep in mind. Necrogen Spellbomb was a cool one that I've seen. Cool in the sense I was like, oh, that's interesting. I forgot that was a card you could use when you just get it for free every turn. It's cool the first few times. I think that spirit of people innovating was a nice feature of the companion era that I hope doesn't get totally lost when the historians are looking back on all this.
I made this analogy before, so I don't want to be a bore with anybody, but it reminds me a lot of the Hogak era, though. The way the card is built requires you to do certain things. So you just like flip through the history of magic for the things you can do that meet that requirement and then do them. So like Hogak also, it took, you know, a couple weeks of people tweaking this number and that number and realizing you could, you know, recast Vengevine every turn, then the innovation is over because it happened every time and it was so consistent. And that's what these turned out to be. Like, there's no counterplay to Companion.
Yeah, so speaking of counterplay, we have another listener question from Kilgore Trout 503, who asks, as someone who has been hosed by Dranith Magistrate twice this week, could there ever be a hate card strong enough to make Companion balanced? For example, what if Dranith Magistrate was a colorless artifact that also had one tap, sack, draw a card, and also had the same text about denying the opponent from casting spells from outside of their hand? I'm going to put this question to Damon, since I know you've been high on Dranith Magistrate yourself. Is there like a non-mechanical fix? Like, is it possible just print cards that would balance out the mechanic?
Like a mental misstep for companions or some type of thing? The pros idea is interesting. I think it just, mental misstep leads to the following problem. You just wind up with these like stupid sub-games involving it. Every deck plays it because there's really no cost and it counters the opponent's mental missteps. But it's an interesting design. I think that as written, actually, Dranith Magistrate is much stronger than you think. So I've been pretty happy with Dranith Magistrate as like a main deckable card in Modern right now. Obviously, it's pretty useless against Ad Nauseam. Sorry, It's pretty useless against Amulet Titan. Against Ad Nauseam, it hoses Lotus Bloom, among other things. Well, mostly just Lotus Bloom against them. But meanwhile, it shuts down a million other cards in Modern. You'll be surprised at how many things it shuts off. So an upgraded Dranath Magistrate actually becomes like an incredibly good Magic card, especially in the companion environment.
The problem with what Kilgar Trar was describing is that this card would immediately be put into a Lurrus deck, and whichever Lurrus deck drew it first would like lock the other person's Lurrus. So yeah, it turns into exactly the subgame that Damon's describing. If you make this card relevant, then whatever companion has descriptions that allow you to play that card, you still get all the benefits of the companion for yourself because they don't print hate cards that are symmetric anymore because people don't like that. Dranath specifically only targets your opponent, unlike Grafdigger's Cage. And you would just use it, so you'd get to play your companion and they wouldn't. So everyone would have to play this card. If you make it colorless, like you're proposing, so that anyone can have it, right? That's the thought. Oh, you don't have to play a specific color to play this hate card. That means that everyone plays it, but everyone also still plays their companion.
Yeah, it would be like Sol Ring and Commander, where if you're building a 100-card deck, you're actually building a 99-card deck, or a 98-card deck after you take out your commander, because you always include Sol Ring.
I have an idea. What if you have this exact same card that Kilgar Trar is proposing, but you give it companion? So it's like you can either choose one of the good companions or you can choose the anti-companion as your companion.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's functionally the same as like trying to ban the mechanic or alter the mechanic so it's not as powerful, though. It's just a way less elegant solution. You know, it's like when they printed all these weirdo cards that did like one damage to flying because they're like, oh, Lingering Souls is insane. It's like the Hellkite sure has this weirdly specific text. It's just like, yeah, we messed up when we printed Lingering Souls and this is like the least elegant way to deal with it. And they've done that throughout time, you know, the way they try to deal with fairies with
General Kudro of Dranath is actually a hate card for Faithless Looting. It was revealed, I think, on one of the Good Morning Magic segments.
perfect technology,
because they work so far in advance that they were like, humans need some main deck way to fight against, you know, Faithless Looting decks and perhaps Hogak.
Yeah, I think if there's a companion, as you mentioned, Dan, it'd kind of be like playing, you know, rock paper. Which side do you want? Nothing beats rock.
Good old rock.
So, speaking of bizarre fixes like that, maybe we can get into the baseless speculation about what might actually happen in this forthcoming BNR change. There's a lot of questions that people have been asking, like, could we tweak the mechanic this way, that way? And we did get some questions from our listeners about specific changes that might help. But maybe just start with a broad one. Question from Alaric Deshane: what creative or otherwise solution might you have for fixing companions if they can be fixed?
All right, so I think there's a bunch of different ways to do it, and I'll just go through the ones that I have heard mentioned. I'm not claiming these are good ideas or bad ideas. These are just common ones I think are reasonable. One is you draw 7 cards in your opening hand and mulligan down to 6, and you have to do that to start the game to play a companion. Two is you do that exact same thing, only you just draw 6. You don't get to draw 7. Three is you do one of those following two, and you don't get to play your commander or your companion from the companion zone. You actually draw into your hand as your 7th card. That one makes it a little more susceptible to discard. Four is you start with 6 cards and you can replace any draw at any point in the game. Or you start with 7 cards, but you can replace any draw at any point in the game with a companion. And the fifth, which is the Matt Sperling solution, which is you can only present a companion from an empty sideboard. So it still functions exactly as it does now. You just lose all 15 cards in your sideboard.
Whoa, what? Is he serious about that one?
Yeah, that's his proposal. And I actually think it's quite interesting. It, first of all, solves the problem of having to see these cards forever. Losing your sideboard makes it basically unplayable in the super old formats, so it makes it kind of a standard only thing where sideboard cards are less important. And it really makes you make tough choices about what to put in your main deck.
Wait, so are you saying that that replaces all companion conditions?
No.
You still have to also meet the condition?
Yeah, so Lutri is just played from an empty sideboard. There's no 14 other cards, but the other 60 or the other 40-ish non-land cards in your deck have to be different. So the penalty is not losing 1 sideboard cards, or losing 15 sideboard cards.
Wow. Okay.
Those are all the ones, if you guys have any other ones that you've heard, but those are the ones I've heard that like seem reasonable to me. And what you can notice what they're all trying to do is mitigate either the extra card that you start with problem, because we found out that many of the conditions the companions ask for is not actually a big ask, or the penalty of losing 1 sideboard slot is incredibly small. What about the penalty of losing all sideboard slots?
Yeah. So just to start with, I'm definitely in favor of just complete banning. I think it's not a good idea to try to fix it, because Wizards has already completely changed the game of Magic in what I would view as a damaging way. And stepping into another damaged game is just not good for the player base, at least from me as a player. But the Sperling solution is interesting. I have one of my own that's kind of a variant of one of those. And that's that You don't draw seven and bottom one, because actually that doesn't really hurt you in terms of the consistency aspect. Whereas drawing a six-card hand reduces your consistency, but then your companion kind of makes up for that. But then the seventh card goes for ante. So
Jeweled Bird makes a comeback in Vintage. And...
So what about adding mana to the companion?
What do you mean?
Like, people have talked about using it like a commander. So, like, to play it from your companion zone, you need to play it, pay an extra two or four colorless.
Yeah.
Frequently heard two, because that's the first charge in commander.
So we just nerf all their CMCs by adding two to them?
I mean, I kind of echo what Damon's saying, though. Like, I think the worst case scenario, and I have to say, I think this is the one we're going to blunder into, is where we make a nerf that is not nerfing enough. So you make this big change to the mechanic, and then Urien is still dominant in Standard and Pioneer, and Luris is still dominant in Modern or whatever. Like Damon's saying, maybe they let you draw seven and put one back, and then you get this extra, it's not an extra card anymore, but it's still, the consistency is so high that this is still the best thing to be doing. So you have this thing where you have this huge disruption, the card doesn't really function as originally intended, but it also still is dominant or super powerful. I think that's the worst case scenario, so I think there should be no half measures on companions. And the one thing I want to say is, without knocking play design, they certainly have not done playtesting for this eventuality. I'm not going to say that they didn't do appropriate playtesting before, although it seems like they didn't. But they certainly haven't said, all right, what are the other variables here if this is so powerful that we have to change this most flagship mechanic for this entire set 3 weeks after its paper release? It's so hard to know, like, exactly how much you have to nerf it to really take all the bullets out of the chamber. So I get a little nervous about some of these halfway measures, and I think they can kind of blunder into worst-case scenarios.
Yeah, and they're confusing for new players. They're just confusing in general.
What do you guys make of the argument that there are no broken mechanics, there's only broken cards?
It's probably true, right? Like, Delve is not broken. If you put a big enough number next to a colored symbol, like, you can have a card that lets you take 50 turns if it's, like, you know, 100. Blue, blue, blue.
Yeah, I mean, like, I was just thinking about how do we get here and the specifics of how these companions were designed. They were mistakes in hindsight, but, like, choosing to make them hybrids so that, you know, more players could enjoy them made them a little too flexible, and it also led them down some pretty narrow mechanical spaces. You know, finding a black-white hybrid mechanic makes it pretty narrow and leads you to some kind of recursion most of the time. And then, you know, they maybe got a few things wrong in the line of text that Luris has. But, like, if they were just gold cards with slightly weaker abilities, yeah, they'd be in that, you know, the Karuga range. We just wouldn't talk about them.
Well, no, we'd be stuck in a meta of black-white auras and Pioneer. Some decks can just play those colors, and then we're stuck with just those decks.
We don't know, because we don't get to run the experiment. I mean, one of the things that's keeping back Karuga is just that there are better companions. It may be, if you deleted all the other companions and Karuga was the only companion we could play, that it would be dominating some of these formats. I can't say that that's not true.
So you guys are both firmly in the mechanic itself should be adjusted, which seems to be what's going to happen. Yeah.
Here's the thing. You know, you do these, like, psychological profiles, and one thing that shows up a lot is people who, like, really care about fairness. That's someone like me. So it always just feels so unfair that your opponent gets to reveal this extra card at the start of the game. Like, it's just so different than how, like, Magic should be played. So it's like the feeling of a mulligan, like, locked into every game for no reason. And so that's just fundamentally, and it's just random, right? If the lines of text on these companions were something that you already wanted to do, like, oh, I already love playing auras. Like, sweet. Then Luris is great, because it just makes a deck you love better. But if you like to brew, if you like to come up with new ideas, then it just punishes you, because the first question it asks is, like, do you meet these random conditions? What if we had set a different condition? Then you could have actually played this card, but we didn't. So for the rest of Magic, you just get punished if you try to not play this card.
And I think I also just disagree with the statement that says there's no broken mechanics, there's only broken cards. I think that's just not true. Like, it is technically true. Like, name a given card, I can nerf it by just making the casting cost infinite. But the thing is that what I consider a broken mechanic is one that is just very, like, unstable, where it's hard to design a card that is playable but not broken, versus, like, a mechanic where you can kind of be on that edge correctly versus a card that's either terrible or busted.
What you're saying about fairness, David, has me thinking of two out-of-the-box solutions. So what if the change is that if your opponent reveals a companion, you get to go to your sideboard and pick one of those cards as your companion?
I mean... This is just like when people are like, oh, if Teferi minus three and only start with three loyalties, like, yes, there's a million levers you could pull. And I'm not going to claim to know, like, what the lever is. Yes, there's everything you're going to describe is better than the companion mechanic as it currently functions. I actually think I'm not literally not heard an outrageous idea that you've said that's worse than the existing idea, which makes it weird. Okay, you're gonna...
You haven't heard my second proposal yet.
Okay.
Second proposal, in the spirit of fairness, the errata is that all legendary creatures now have companion, and their companion condition is your deck must only contain cards in the same color identity as your legendary companion.
All right, that one is actually worse. That's the only one that's worse.
All right, I mean, that would be fair. That would open up a lot of space for everyone could have one.
That's the crazy thing where people are like, oh, we should print a bunch more companions. Like, why was the solution to Oko now printing a bunch more, like, broken three-mana planeswalkers? It's like, the answer cannot be to make more things companions.
Well, hold on. Damn, I'd be honest, something. I mean, one of the most frustrating things with Lurrus is they always have Mishra's Bauble, right? So what if we just, like, made them have to play Highlander? And maybe have to play, like, 100-card decks, you know? Like,
yeah.
Any legendary but Highlander 100-card deck. It's kind of like, it combines both Urien and Lutri. But you can pick any legend.
Right. If you want to play Commander, then you should just play Commander against my legitimate modern deck. Call it square.
Okay, so of all the changes we've kicked around, anyone care to speculate on which one is likely to happen or which one would be the best fix? I mean, obviously the one, when you say ban it, you're meaning ban as companion. So the effectively removing the companion clause and you could still use these cards fairly.
I would, if you said, what would David Robertson do? He would say that companion now functions like conspiracy and in non-limited games, it is not legal. Or I would go even farther and basically say like the sideboard cannot be affected by things like you can't play cards from outside the game. Affect the way that wishes, the Fae of Wishes, all that stuff, none of that should be actually able to tutor your sideboard, including Karn. I actually think that's more how I think Magic should work. That's like a bigger ask. It hoses a bunch of other cards that would be innocent bystanders in this. But one of those two is the fix that ought to be made. If you're making me guess what I think Wizards will do, I think they will do the London Mulligan. I think they'll have you draw 7, put one underneath your deck, and then reveal your companion, and it will be cast in the companion zone. I don't think they'll let you put it in your hand, which is tough. I mean, not being able to discard is a thing that makes them so powerful. It's what really punishes, like, Jund decks. Just think when the weeks when we were kind of, like, joking around with Muldrifter, and I was, like, viling in the Charming Prince to blink it after evoking it, and I was just, like, crushing with this joke meme deck, crushing Jund decks, because I was getting to play Muldrifter. It's so good against Jund. Now it's like you get a way better Muldrifter for free that can never be Thoughtseized. And it has a giant body, so it like blocks everything and doesn't die to Bolt. So if you can't discard Urien, it's not going to fix the problem. Like, I think they're going to do that, and I think it's not going to be good enough. And Urien's just going to be like an insanely powerful thing to do in Pioneer and Standard. I think Urien deck's by far the best thing to be doing in Pioneer. And it's not obviously a question at all that they're by far the most powerful thing to be doing in Standard.
Yeah, remember when Wizards banned Bridge from Below?
And we all thought that was going to be enough. There was a 3-week lull where we didn't realize that Hogek was still a problem.
It made it better, actually.
But we didn't know that.
But that's my point, is this, the history of half measures is that they don't work because they spent a lot of time, in theory, designing Hogek, and it was broken in a day. So, of course, their first measure is not going to be that effective. They had even less time to test the fix. And this is a standard set, right? So they spend a lot of time designing it and designing the decks. And obviously they got the whatever levers you think that they should have pulled or not pulled, they got it wrong, obviously, because there has to be banned so quickly. So I just don't have a lot of confidence that we can be super confident about what to do. So I'm more of a, like, aliens, like, blow it up from space, man, Ripley style. It's the only way to be sure. Otherwise, the goddamn alien's going to get in the boat and eat the thing, and then Paul Reiser, you know, is a slimy accountant or whatever. I mean, it's just, shit just goes down the wrong way. So listen to James Cameron. Out into space, nuke it from space. Don't fuck around.
It's the undo button. Press undo.
Yeah.
Okay, Damon, your prediction?
My prediction is that they ban it. They hit the undo button or the nuclear orbit or whatever David was referencing from Aliens.
So you can no longer use them as companions, but you can still play them as normal cards if you want to.
Correct.
I don't have a good read on what they're going to do. I would guess it would be what David said, but you will put the companion in your hand, and that will have big ramifications, like you were saying about Thalsy's decks and that kind of thing. But that just feels like more of a nerfing that people will be happier with, because there's just another access to interact with it. But who knows?
Putting your hand is so... it's tricky.
I mean, it makes it a lot less attractive, right?
It makes it slightly less attractive. Imagine if you just could always start the game with a Snapcaster Mage in hand.
Yeah, but it costs you a card.
Yeah, so your seventh card is always a Snapcaster Mage. You every time you look at your opening hand, is always there's always one Snapcaster Mage. Exactly one. Not more than one, not less than one, just one.
I mean, if my prediction is correct, we won't have to imagine it. That will be the reality we will be living in just a few short days.
Dan is known for his sage predictions over the course of Magic BNR updates, so we've learned to listen to his wisdom on these matters.
The best prediction, though, was I think Wizards is not going to print any escape cards that are broken. And then the next week, you're like, I don't can't believe you guys don't think all these escape cards are broken. I was like, you promised me last week they had set the cost at the exact right point. Then like 3 days into paper, they already had banned a card in Legacy. It's like, well, I haven't sorted that one out yet.
In my defense, somebody on play design is me, right? They're like coming up with lines of text for General Kudro Draenith to make sure we can keep playing our Faithless Looting decks.
Right.
It should not have been banned. We can balance it out. We'll come up with some tech. Okay, a couple of hypothetical questions. This question comes from Camberleaf. So in the scenario in which Companion as a mechanic is banned and you can only use these cards now as main deck cards, what happens to the metagame diversity from there? Does this benefit any particular decks or like what's left of the metagame? Where would it go?
Are you talking Modern or Pioneer?
That's not specified, so take that as you will.
So this is in the scenario where you just ban Companions.
Banned as Companions, yeah. But you can still use them if you want to.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the formats basically revert to pre-Ikoria plus... I don't even know what the best cards in Ikoria are now. They've been so outshadowed by the whole Companion mess.
Yeah, I kind of want a do-over on Ikoria release season, you know?
Yeah.
Like, there were a bunch of cool cards in the set.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't think that Vaedrak and Song of Creation will be making waves in Modern. I've tried them. You know, they're fine, but they're not going to set the world on fire.
I think Song of Creation is, like, actually pretty good. We just haven't had the incentive to...
Perhaps, yeah, yeah.
It's just clearly worse than what's currently available in Modern.
That's true. That's true. I was trying those cards in the lens of a Companion format, and frequently Companion decks just would wreck me.
Yeah, I mean, it's so hard to say. I do think, like, on rate, Ikoria did not actually generate a bunch of cards that are immediately powerful. It's going to be another, like, corner case build around that was specifically excluding being able to play the more powerful Companions. So if one of those cards ends up being a thing, that it'll be its own deck. But I don't think there's a lot of cards that just naturally add to existing decks. I do think Cling to Dust is a card, like Damon said, we've seen is generically powerful. So maybe that card, you know, ends up at a couple sideboards or something. I'm not sure if it's like a 4x main deckable if there isn't, you know, 50% Lurrus decks running around.
Yeah. Ikoria has a lot of Modern playables, but they seem more like kind of role players than things you rebuild a deck around. You know, like Neutralize or Fire Prophecy, Cling to Dust. You don't like build my new Cling to Dust deck, you know. You slide it into some existing deck.
And for the record, Cling to Dust is not from Ikoria.
Ah.
The Sprite Dragon might open up some space in a couple other formats. So, but like you say, we haven't had the incentive to try to like make, you know, some of these cards work because it's like, oh, it doesn't really work with the best Companions. So
yeah, Sprite Dragon is a good Magic card. That's a card that you could build around or take a deck that sort of exists right now and make it like a good deck.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we'll have a Sprite Dragon week coming up soon.
Yeah.
So shifting gears then to the final piece of this teaser tweet. So there is going to be some change to Standard and Historic. Any thoughts on what that might be? We historically have not talked about Historic or Standard, but do you guys have a sense of like what might that format need or what's prompting this change?
Let me go grab my tea leaves over there.
I never like to predict what Wizards will do because I obviously don't think about the game in the same way they do. But what I would do is ban Teferi and ban Wilderness Reclamation and possibly Fires. But those two for sure. I think Teferi is the card that keeps people from being able to interact with the Urion Fires package. Typically what you'd normally have against that is cards like Disdainful Stroke and cheap interactive counter spells would be great. Instead, Disdainful Stroke like literally can't counter Teferi. So if they resolve that, the card doesn't do anything for the rest of the game. So you've like locked out the tempo decks a way to punish these decks that just want to play 4 and 5 mana sorceries. So their deck's just full of them. And they almost don't do anything else. That would be my thought process. I don't think you need to ban Agent of Treachery. I do imagine that Agent of Treachery wasn't as much of a problem because they were always playtesting it when the one green prevent...
Veil of Summer.
Yeah, Veil of Summer was legal, so it just always felt like it wasn't that big of a deal. I'm sure they found the Luca Agent thing. I mean, that was pretty obvious. But if they were always playtesting with Veil of Summer being legal, it wouldn't seem that broken.
I would be okay with them banning Agent of Treachery, just in terms of like how you feel when you walk away from a match. It's kind of like what I imagine Nexus must have felt like. I wasn't playing a lot of Standard when that was still legal, but it's just like one of the worst feelings. Unfortunately, it just like plays so well into what Standard has been about. You mentioned Wilderness Reclamation and Fires. So those are like two of the big three mana engines, right? There's Wilderness Rec, there's Fires of Invention, Nissa, who shakes the world, has been dominant in Standard, is currently not doing very well. And then you could even throw Winota, Joiner of Forces on the pile as like a big mana engine. These are like the most powerful things, but like they've all coalesced around Agent of Treachery as like the best thing to do with all that mana, right? Hydroid Crisis is old news. Even like Temur Elementals topping off on Genesis Ultimatums, you're playing that so that you can hit Agent of Treacheries and then blink it all with Urien. Every game seems to end with Agent is the endgame in Standard right now. The ways to get to the endgame are things like Fires or Luka, perhaps. So I think that if you take out Wilderness Wreck, you have to like maybe try to take out all the mana engines. I don't know if they would consider that. That seems drastic. And then Teferi doesn't even necessarily fit into that scheme unless it's like you're saying, David, where like that's the thing that makes it possible to play these strategies without getting punished too hard.
Because you just keep naming cards that Disdainful Stroke destroys. Like Disdainful Stroke is so good against Urien, it's so good against Fires, it's so good against Luka, and it's so good against Agent.
Yeah, Standard is such a mess to fix. I mean, the problem is that I was reading some Reddit posts that were like, oh, you know, Teferi is fine. Like, there's not even any flash decks around. Well, the reason there's no flash decks around is because there's Teferi in the format. If you ban Teferi, Wilderness Reclamation becomes a much better Magic card, for example. And so it's like the impact of banning one of these linchpin cards on the rest of the format already will have huge ripple effects, much less banning multiples of them. And it just seems very, very hard to imagine how you fix this. Like, do you ban all four mana doubler engines that you mentioned, Dan? Like, if you only ban two of them, it feels like the other two will reign supreme. If you ban Agent of Treachery, is there another good endgame? You know, Andre's Forerunners can put a one-hit kill on people. Some other, you know, big mana card.
Yeah, it does seem like, not that it's carefully balanced now, but it's one of those, you bring in the mongoose to hunt the rats, and then you bring in the monitor lizard to hunt the mongoose, and then you bring in like the pandas to hunt the whatever. It's just like, I hope winter kills everything. Like, we're just waiting for rotation desperately, but they've slowed rotation down because that had other problems when rotation was too fast. You know, players didn't like that. So the one thing that like people have argued, no one's arguing that Teferi is like a positive gameplay experience. The most prominent argument is that it rotates in 3 months and that that set is built around Teferi. And so they don't want to ban Teferi because Teferi is like the character they've built their next set around. And so that would be bad. And again, we don't know. Just like Damon's saying, there's so many variables. You pull out Teferi, does Wilderness Wreck get too good? You pull out Wilderness Wreck, does Fires get too good? You pull out Fires, does Nissa? Now you're just using Nissa to cast Agent of Treachery. You know, how many... are we just banning everything until... You know, some people are talking about banning the Oven or the Cats or, you know, one half of that combo because that's quote-unquote miserable to play against. Maybe that becomes too good if we take away all these late-game pieces, so...
My hope is that they ban everything until Blue-Red Flash featuring Gadwick becomes good again. That deck was awesome.
And what do you think that would take, like 16 bans, Damon?
I don't even know.
Most of Ikoria has to become illegal, including the flagship mechanic.
I mean, Neutralize is a pretty good upgrade for that deck.
True.
Fire Prophecy is also pretty good. The deck got some upgrades, but yeah, it's pretty bad right now.
Sprite Dragon.
Can you? I'm not actually sure you play that in the Flash deck. It's tricky.
I think I'm coming around on Teferi being like the key piece that has to... Once you take the Teferi layer away, there's a chance for like an interesting dynamic environment. Probably some second card should go to... I don't know whether that should be Agent or Wreck or Fires or something else. What about Historic? This is not a format that anyone has ever really talked about in any serious capacity, except that now we've had an organized play announcement in which one of the upcoming Pro Tour formats, or I guess it's not a Pro Tour, but one of the upcoming Premier Event formats will be Historic. So in the next couple of months, there will be more attention paid to that metagame. People will be testing it and trying to break it. Any thoughts on that?
Remember when Pioneer came out and WotC played Whack-A-Mole for 2 months straight every week? I feel like Historic is in that phase. And so there's just a super unstable meta. It seems like Winota is by far the best thing to be doing in that format. So probably, you know, whack that mole. Who knows what's the next best thing to do?
And yeah, then it seems like the next best things to do are Field of the Dead and the 7-mana instant take an extra turn. Now, right now, their win rates, which is what people are pointing to, are not that high because Winota is the best performing deck by percentage. But like Damon said, we haven't had that much actual data from a bunch of competitive people playing against each other. Historic really is people who enjoy like casual, cool brews. You know, it is kind of a brewer's paradise right now. We saw in Pioneer, there was like a few weeks of that. And then people are like, oh, you just play this mono green deck and just kill people on turn three over and over again. And I think people are realizing once you coalesce around the two or three primary end games, that's where it's going to end up without them monitoring or managing the format a little more proactively. It'd be a shame for Winota to get banned. I mean, a card that can at least be killed, it doesn't even have a come into play effect. Obviously, you're like sort of held prisoner. You always have to keep your like two mana up to kill it. But if that's the best thing you can be doing, that actually seems kind of reasonable to me compared to some of this other stuff. But maybe that's just me.
It's apparently dominating the format is the strange thing.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe they don't have the tools to deal with it. I don't know what removal is like reasonable to play in the format.
So a question from One With Nothing, who asks, Historic is a unique format in that Wizards is picking and choosing specific cards to include in the format rather than entire sets. So this is referring to the Historic anthologies, of which there are now three of them, injections of 20 handpicked cards to sort of liven things up. What do you think about this approach, and what do you think their goals are with the format as compared to other large formats? How would you like to see the format evolve?
Personally, I'm not a huge fan of this injection approach. I just find that it's very hard as a player to have a sense of what's in the format. Maybe it's because I don't play Arena, but like I just don't actually really know what's in Historic, to be honest. Like, I think Thalia's in there, for example. Modern, I know Modern Border card means is in Modern. Pioneer, I kind of know Return to Ravnica Onwards in Pioneer. Standard, I know that Ravnica Onwards, actually, maybe I don't know.
Well, I think it's a barrier to entry for someone who does not play Arena, but I think the goal of Historic as a format is to be a place where you can use everything legal on Arena. So if you're just an Arena player, it's very simple. Anything that's on your Arena client, whether that was a promo card or some weirdo anthology card, Historic is the place to play it. Whether that's your cards that rotated out or something, you have nothing to do with them now. So I think that's why Historic exists. And, you know, there was some talk, would they be backfilling more sets? Currently, Historic begins at Ixalan, but it could go back earlier than that if they made more of those sets available. They're talking about having remastered sets from Kaladesh and Amonkhet. So it would grow. They've even talked about having, you know, Pioneer in the next year on Arena. So it would sort of have to, I think the future long-term for Historic is a little bit clouded by the fact that Pioneer exists, and they've expressed some interest in making Pioneer fully available on Arena. But until that happens, or maybe because that's going to happen, you need these injections of cards from the anthologies to like give it its own feel as a format.
I understand that it's necessary. I guess my concern is just that people already talk about how Pioneer detracted from the Modern player base. It just kind of fractured it. And Historic is like this thing that's sort of like Pioneer, it looks like, from the games I've seen. And what is the purpose of having these kind of two formats? It just seems like, will people play Historic in paper, or is it meant to be an only Arena thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that question is yet to be answered. I think the reason Historic exists is because Standard is miserable for huge percentages of the year. You always have this like fallback different format people can play. You know, one of the nice things is like if Pioneer's terrible, you can play Modern. If Modern's terrible, you can play Legacy. On Arena, you just have Standard, and if you're not a limited player, that's frustrating, I think. As far as the injections, I agree with one of Damon's points. It's super hard to know what's in there. So I think that's why when the pros turn their eyes to this and start looking at the card list, it's going to dramatically change the format, because people can't do the things that they're doing in Pioneer, which is just port the best decks in each Standard format and just match them up and see which extra cards they add. You actually have to like build from scratch. Like, Knight of the Reliquary being legal in there but not in Pioneer is really interesting. So I think it does succeed in being not like a big Standard like Pioneer. It's actually way more varied in certain ways. In other ways, it's very daunting to start from zero, because you have to look at each of these anthologies specifically, and then you add those to this Standard player or Standard card base. I think once you get beyond that initial point, then that frees you up to look at some card interactions and things that are unique. And the fact that are cherry-picking these cards hopefully means that they're always picking cards that have interesting and unique effects. So I think there's some positives and some negatives.
How much of your brewing do you do in Arena, Dan?
I don't think I understand the question. What do you mean by brew them in Arena?
Like, if you're brainstorming a deck idea, do you go to Arena and assemble a deck there? Or do you use, you know, Scryfall or Goldfish or a piece of paper or just your brain or some other resource to figure out what cards you want to play in your deck?
Oh, well, I recommend that everyone use Scryfall. I think that brewing without access to a fully responsive search engine like that, you're losing a lot of time that way. I mean, I get that, yeah, that is one way to do it. It's like you open up Magic Online client or the Arena client and you go to the search bar and type in keywords and hope you find something that fits your strategy. I think people do that, but I don't do that and I don't think anyone should. Why do you ask?
Oh, because you had the point earlier that says like, oh, well, the Historic rule is it's legal if and only if it's available in Arena, but that only is a usable rule to help understand what you can brew with if you're literally sitting in the Arena client. Otherwise, you have to just go to a rule source. at some point you internalize what's in Pioneer and what isn't. You know, like I don't necessarily think of what the best white removal is. You know, like, oh yeah, we'll return to Ravnica head blah, you know, I'm gonna get a blah. I just think like, oh, it's like Seal Away or whatever. Or Baffling End. And I don't have to like think too hard. But if you like are going into fringe cards, you think, oh yeah, this card was printed since Return to Ravnica in this one set. Whereas Historic, you just have to memorize it, basically, it sounds like.
The new cards added with each anthology is pretty small, though. I mean, the collective total of the three anthologies is only like 75 cards or something.
That's fair. Okay. So you're saying I should just look at that list of 75 cards? I could do that.
Those are all tend to be very powerful cards. You know, like I said, Knight of the Reliquary is the one that sticks out to me. It's a cool card that's not legal in Pioneer, is legal in Modern. Well, it's legal in Modern, but it's soft banned, as we like to say, in the same way Liliana is. You're allowed to put it in your deck, and you're also allowed to just shake your opponent's hand and shuffle up and move on to the 0-1 bracket as well.
Yeah, there's a sweet clip of me playing a green-white deck in Modern and in our Rogue Refinery episode from this week, and you can see that just all is dust, destroying everything I was working towards.
Okay, so one last question, and this one's a little more broad, but I think it's interesting to think about. This is from Jack Lionheart. Jack Lionheart asks, WotC seems to be printing lots of engine cards, for example, Lurrus, Emry, Kinnan, Song of Creation, Fires of Invention. What do you think about banning the ones that are too powerful, so banning the engine cards that prove to be too powerful, versus limiting the fuel or the enablers, the pieces like Arkham's Astrolabe, Mishra's Bauble, that make those engines really efficient?
It's kind of a loaded question because let's say they weren't going to nerf the companion mechanic that for some reason we had to keep it. And you were looking at Modern and you said, well, the card that really, I think, turns like Lurrus from very good to oppressive is Mishra's Bauble, right? So you can ban Bauble or ban Lurrus in the format as a companion. One of the questions you need to ask is does Wizards have in its card file out into the future, and they design cards, whatever, 3 years out in the future, do they have a bunch of other cards that are going to keep playing Bauble for free? Because Bauble keeps dodging being banned, and then new cards keep getting printed that can use it, right? So Bauble is also very powerful with Emry, Lurker of the Lock. If they're going to print a card that interacts with Bauble in this favorably every couple of sets, then they should just ban Bauble now to try to preserve Lurrus. Now, we know that they're nerfing the companion mechanic, et cetera, so that the case starts to break down there. But the future file tells you what these things do. If they're easy to take advantage of, right, like Dig Through Time has been in combo deck after combo deck after combo deck, relatively easy to take advantage of this because it's just a generically powerful draw spell. But if it's something that's really specific, you know, I don't think you need to ban specifically the card Inverter, unless you know you're going to be printing a bunch of other cards that have text like the 4-mana Jace or the Oracle.
This may make me sound stupid, but I'm in favor of preserving enablers and banning the engine payoffs. Because enablers enable things, I just like cards that make things possible. And if you have a format full of 4-mana enchantment engines and stuff, but nothing cheap, like no Wild Growth, no Utopia Sprawl to actually get those out, you just end up nowhere. I don't like the fact that in order to preserve Urza, Mox Opal is gone. I understand that, like, yes, it was maybe fine for format health reasons and people are enjoying their Urza decks, but like I liked how Mox Opal just made it possible to do weird stuff with different artifact strategies, whatever that may be. And I don't just mean Classic Affinity, I mean like any artifact strategy. So in that sense, like, yeah, I just mourn for some of the enablers. I understand that some of them are too good and you don't want too many, but just think about if you're playing a graveyard deck and you just want to find some way to get the card from your hand into your graveyard. What are you going to do? There's no Faithless Looting. What is the next best enabler? And there just isn't one. You're just left with like really sad cards in your deck, like Haggle or whatever. I think that just makes me a little bit sad as someone who likes having the idea of a format where anything's possible. So I prefer enablers being given a little more free rein and you just like whack the payoffs as they come up and prove themselves broken.
Yeah, the examples given in the question I think are quite good ones. Astrolabe and Bauble. I'm realizing now that I think Bauble and Metamorphose are just kind of just messed up magic cards. They are free and they cantrip, and this just leads to them being broken in all sorts of weird ways. You know, your promised opponent could just play, you know, turn one Swift Sphere, turn two Metamorphose, 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 Metamorphose. Like, the game lets you do that because it costs basically free. And this is just weird that, like, this is a thing you can do in Magic. Bauble is similar. Like, I just don't see why you should have a zero-mana artifact that cantrips on use that also lets you secretly peek at your opponent's deck every turn or every time you use it and can also help set up your scry engine with a fetch land. I would not actually be opposed to see these cards go. I think Mox Opal also just leads to these broken starts. You're on the play and you have an Opal start. It's just like so hard to recover when you're on the draw with a deck that doesn't have the ability to do that. Sprawl and Wild Growth, I think, are not at that level.
The other problem with these enabler arguments is that what happens is you keep having to ban cards over and over again from the same kind of shell. So let's say, okay, we wanted to keep Opal, but we ban Urza. And I actually would be in favor of that. I don't like Urza. Okay, so we banned Urza and we have Opal. Well, Opal would 100% have had to get banned in the world of Lurrus. So, all right, fine. Then we have to ban Lurrus before we even get to the companion nerf, which is, you know, going to happen on the first. We'd already have had to ban Lurrus. And then in the next set, you know, there's going to be some other cheap artifact. Maybe Ozolith. Even after we ban Lurrus, Opal's still too good. All right, then we have to ban Ozolith, or do we ban, like, Ravager? And now it's like, well, which card is actually the more, like, classic part of Affinity? You know, Ravager allows certain decks to exist, and Opal also does. So now we're in, like, two enablers are competing against each other.
And they are taking the route that you're saying. I think there's a non-zero chance that Mishra's Bauble does not survive for another 3 months, regardless of what happens with Lurrus. Okay, well, I think that can wrap up our baseless speculation portion. And as always, you can check back on the first and see exactly how wrong we all were.
And this is in no ways financial advice. Please do not make any major life purchases or decisions based off of anything we have said.
Sage advice. On that note, we will take a short break. When we come back, we will take a look at some of the lessons we have learned from our last few weeks of brewing around some unlikely contenders from Ikoria. Stick around.
And we are back. So we kind of have a two-part flashback this week, and we're going to talk about cards that we showcase on our Rogue Refinery show. So the first card we want to talk about is Vaedroc, Apex of Thunder. He was featured on Rogue Refinery Episode 3. Dan took Vaedroc through his or its paces in Standard. I took a bunch of different decks through a bunch of different queues in Pioneer. And Damon Gamely tried to make this card work in Modern.
So what does this mysterious Vaedroc card do? It is red, white, blue for a 3/3 elemental dinosaur cat. It is legendary, which actually is quite relevant. Flying first strike, that's the base stats. And then mutate for one red, red, and blue-white hybrid mana, so 4 mana total to mutate. With the mutation clause, whenever this creature mutates, you may cast target non-creature card with CMC 3 or less from your graveyard without paying its mana cost, and it will, you know, doesn't mention at all that it gets exiled. So straight right back to the graveyard.
Yeah, and in terms of rules quirks, don't forget that you can't do this onto humans, right? Mutants can only mutate onto non-humans.
Who could ever forget that? I think, and by that I mean everybody. What's a weird clause?
Yeah, it has all kinds of weird creature types. I had a game where I won because the opponent tried to do a Chandra 3 damage to all non-elemental creatures, and my Vaedroc survived. So there's just all kinds of weird stuff with this. It's definitely a card that takes getting used to, I'll put it that way.
That is a quirk with Big Chandra, to be fair, not a quirk with Vaedroc. I've been blown out by that before in my Canlander deck, where I'm like, why didn't that Vengevine go away?
So I think the first thing we want to do when we talk about a card like this is what kind of deck are we trying to build? And Dan, you were kind of conceptualizing it in sort of, you know, some generic archetypes.
Yeah, one thing that I always love to do is theorycraft a card at great length, which I don't get to do on the video show. But yeah, I think basically what it came down to was thinking about what does Vaedroc actually do well. It's all about what do you get back off the mutate trigger. So a mutate is a mechanic that just hasn't really broken through at all in Constructed. So it's got a bunch of like weird quirks and a bunch of weird modes where you're not even sure if you're going to get the mutate trigger. Like, what if a creature dies in response? So you have to like, A, come up with a deck that's going to get something exciting off Vaedroc's mutate trigger. And then B, you have to account for fail states. And it's just like a big juggling balancing act. You need to have enough creatures to mutate onto. You also need to rebuy something of value from the graveyard. That is a non-creature spell of CMC 3 or less. And basically, I think what I tentatively arrived at was that if you're not getting back a 3-mana spell or a tempo-positive spell, like actual removal spell, you're not really getting a good deal on Vaedroc. The mutate upgrade is actually quite small in terms of combat stats. Vaedroc is only a 3-3, and you're paying 4 mana to get the trigger and the perhaps upgrade on the creature.
Yeah, playing a 3-CMC, 3-3 flying first strike flyer in Modern is just not that good, and upgrading a creature to a 3-3 flying first strike pseudo-haste is also not that good. It's really all about the trigger.
And especially if you're paying for that mutate trigger, you're paying extra, so you're actually paying 4 mana, If they kill the creature in response, okay, yeah, you didn't get blown out in the sense that you lose your guy, but you did get blown out. Like, paying 4 mana for a worse Lightning Angel is basically game losing in Pioneer or Modern.
Yeah, and there are ways to make it slightly more exciting. So on the video show, I talk a lot about how you can use creatures that have +1/+1 counters to make it actually a bigger boost, right? I was using cards like Spray Dragon, Chamber Sentry. You can't use Stonecoil Serpent, unfortunately, because of the protection from multicolor. But there are ways around that where you can actually get a large flyer. So one of the shells that I thought might be possible was like a tempo shell where the turn you mutate Vajrak, you're actually making something large and having an impactful 3-mana spell from the graveyard. So that was sort of one broad class of decks that we explored. The second broad class, I think, was trying to address the tension of, like, how do you have creatures in play to mutate onto while still having spells in the graveyard? And the solution was, well, use spells that produce creatures, like use token makers. So just some sort of tokens deck where when you mutate Vajrak onto a token, you'll also get opportunity to, like, recast a token-making spell. And then I think the third and probably least successful angle that we explored was some kind of combo deck. And this was based on the fact that a quirk of Vajrak's text is that when you recast something from the graveyard, it goes back to the graveyard. It doesn't get exiled. So in theory, you can recast the same thing over and over again. And that actually also plays into the way the mutate mechanic stacks up. If you keep mutating more copies of Vajrak itself or other mutants, you're getting multiple Vajrak triggers. Damon talked about times where he just like had 3 or 4 mutants sort of mashed up in one creature. You could potentially cast a lot of metamorphoses that way. Broadly speaking, that was a third space in which I thought there might be some room to explore in Vajrak. So taking a look at these tempo strategies then, the standard deck that I arrived at I think is actually pretty good, and I talk about this at length on the video show, so I don't want to repeat myself too much, but I guess the question that I have for you guys is, do you think that some kind of version of this could work in Pioneer? Because when I look at my deck list, a lot of these cards look like they're good enough for Pioneer. What cards am I talking about? Well, I have my 4 Vajraks. The main card I want to mutate onto is Sprite Dragon, but I also have some Spectral Sailors, some Chamber Sentries as additional copies of things that I can put a Vajrak onto, or I can put Sea Dasher Octopus onto those cards as well. The big get in terms of the Vajrak trigger is Teferi Time Raveler, a card potentially banned in Standard, we don't know. That's just such a perfect tempo positive play. It's like a extremely valuable permanent that also casts a bounce spell when you get it back. And it even protects your Vajrak so that they can't interrupt you when you're trying to do your thing. Do you guys think that like something like this, perhaps with access to the better mana in Pioneer, is at all viable?
I tried something very similar. You know, the first list I had like 4 Teferi in it because I was like, this is the best 3-mana thing to get back. You know, the problem is that the removal is just so efficient in Pioneer. It's not just that every color has it, although that is the problem. It's also that it's so cheap. So they're always trading up with you, and being able to fatal push whatever it is that you're doing is crushing. The 1 in a black edict enchantment that the Urion decks are playing to blink is also crushing because you kind of go tall instead of wide. Teferi's nice, it stops counterspells, but there actually aren't that many counterspells anymore. The Urion decks do not rely on counterspell interactions because they're so much more permanent heavy. They might have a few counterspells, but Teferi also beats you because it stops your Vajrak, and then all these other like red-white Lurrus decks have super cheap 1-mana interaction that kills all the stuff you might want to Vajrak onto. So each individual card you're playing makes a lot of sense, and then the games, you're finding that you're losing mana or tempo or material on the board with every interaction, and at the end of doing that 3 or 4 times, and you're not playing a companion, it's pretty brutal. I think I went like 0-3 or 0-4 drop, and then 0-3 or 0-4 drop like twice with various tweaks to the list, so.
Yeah, the thing with Vajrak that I learned is that the mutate trigger, it looks like this nice ETB thing that like, oh, how could you lose, but if you mutate onto something and that happens fine and you get this trigger, you bring back maybe even a Teferi. If they kill the mutate creature, like it's still pretty bad for you. Like one of the best parts of Vajrak is it sets you up for future mutates really well. And so it's like the second mutate where you really start to achieve your value. But if it dies before then, you're actually pretty far behind, even if you got a good tempo play on the first time.
Yeah, and what happened to me is like, okay, I resolve it and I get my Teferi back that somehow went to the graveyard, and already you're behind, right? Because you played Teferi, that was your like removal spell on their prowess creature. Then they Wizard's Lightning your Vaydrock creature for one mana, and then they attack and kill your Teferi, and you're just like, man, I did all this work, and my board is clean as a whistle. There is nothing left to show for what I did. I drew a card or two.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I think maybe this is just more at standard speed. And even that, you know, you got to put an asterisk by it because this is an off-meta standard strategy for sure. There's nothing like this in standard. I think the only reason it's even sort of can be contemplated is that there's just not a lot of spot removal in standard. There's either these go wide rush decks, you know, mono red, mono black, or there's just like the go big engine, big mana decks. So there is like some room. I was surprised how often my creatures were surviving until I could get the Vaydrock going. But maybe that's a standard specific thing. I'm not surprised it didn't work out in Modern and Pioneer, or that in Modern and Pioneer, you guys both arrived at like hexproof creatures as the necessary evil, as we talked about last week with Emma Partlow.
I will say one kind of cool interaction in one of the variants of that tempo shell that I built was the card Of One Mind. So for people who don't know, who aren't psychos like me scouring the legal card limits, Of One Mind is divination. Two and a blue, draw two cards. But it costs two colorless less if you control a human creature and a non-human creature. So one of the ways that this can be easily met is if you have a young pyromancer and a token, or if you have a Monastery Mentor and a token. So it kind of does double duty. It's a cheap card to go to the graveyard, so Teferi does not always go to the graveyard, right? Sometimes you minus it and then like plus it twice, and so you don't actually have fuel for your Vaydrock. This is a reasonably powerful effect that goes to the graveyard. You're not getting quite 3 mana out of it, but 2 mana to draw 2 is maybe like too powerful for a Pioneer, so you're getting like 2.5 mana, let's say. But you often get to cast it on the front side for one, so it's easy to put it in your graveyard on curve. You could play like Young Pyromancer on 2, Opt, and then this on 3, and then Vaydrock on 4. Obviously, they can kill your creatures, but we'll just ignore that. And then when you flash it back with Vaydrock, you're actually getting like a reasonably powerful effect. It's a lot better than Opt, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, actually, 2-mana draw 2 is probably busted in Legacy. People play Predict, and you have to jump through a hoop for that.
I think there's a shell there where you're playing Young Pyromancer anyway. This card and that and Vaydrock and, you know, probably some number of Monastery Mentors is an area that I explored a little bit. Especially now that you don't get punished for not playing Lurrus as much. Again, we'll have to see what the new companion text is or if it exists at all. If there's not like a plethora of shocks around, you can build a much more reasonable shell based around that. And you're getting so many cards from all these interactions that you're set up to go a little bit longer. If your sort of tempo plan fails, they can handle all your Young Pyromancer tokens or whatever.
Yeah. Another direction to go like this deck is you say, well, Vaydrock, I don't know about that. It's too risky. But C-Dash or Octopus in some sort of tempo deck in Pioneer, that's some spice. I was testing for the Faithless Brewing Community League we're running, and our first week is Pioneer, which I haven't played too much of. And I decided to try net decking this Jeskai Yorian Fires deck that everybody's talking about, so I learned about both Pioneer and Standard somehow. And round one, I'm up against like mono blue tempo flash or whatever, featuring Spectral Sailors, C-Dash or Octopuses, Brazen Borrowers, Ashiok Erasure somehow. I'm not really sure why, but it was good against me. I cast Supreme Verdict and got erased. So basically take this list and cut maybe half the cards and make them, you know, a little flashier and less Vaydrock. Which may be a totally different deck at that point, to be fair.
I wanted to ask you, Damon, about the original Modern list that set us down the Vaydrock path many weeks ago. And this was from the first Ikoria 5-0 dump. It was largely trying to recast the card Tribal Flames, thanks to a mana base that now has access to a fetch Triome mana base. It's pretty easy, I think, to get all 5 land types and cast Tribal Flames for a full 5 damage every time you cast it. So it was kind of like a zoo deck with 4 copies of Vaydrock. You got a chance to try this out a little bit. What did you think of it? And was there anything there in terms of like using big burn spells as the tempo finisher?
So I played this deck through, I think, 4 rounds. I went 1-3 drop. And it was a strange league. I had this really big problem that the list was playing 4 Vaydrocks. And I would just draw like way too many Vaydrocks every game. I would like draw my opener. I'd be like, I would mull the hand. I would mull my hand with like 2 Vaydrocks, I would bottom one, and by turn 3, I have 3 Vaydrocks in hand. Too many Vaydrocks is not good, but that was just like weird. Like I wouldn't play 4. I think that, you know, certainly increases the odds of this going wrong in that way. It might be worth taking a list like this through a league, but just with like a few tweaks to it. It is true that flashing back tribal flames is big game. Five damage is huge. With this type of deck, you can usually put your opponent under a lot of pressure with your one drops that they have to tap out at some point. They just like kind of can't catch up by not tapping out, and this gives you a window to get your Vaedrock value.
What's interesting about the list is that the one drops in question are not the prowess one drops, because those are humans. You can't play the Swift Spear or the Soulscar Mage or whatever. So instead they're using Narn and Renegade and Wild Nacatl, which both have text that actually works well with Mutate. Like, you, I think, will get a 5-5 if you put Vaedrock onto a Wild Nacatl.
Yep.
Yeah, that was a good design. I will say that my first experience mutating a creature in the game of Magic was mutating a Vaedrock onto a Tarmogoyf. And the MTGO interface doesn't really make it very clear to begin with. It uses like phrasing over and under and then on top. And it's like, well, which one is like on top vertically on the screen, or the one that's on top as if the screen was like a 3D representation of a Magic board? And so I got very confused when it turns out Tarmogoyf just overrides whatever you do. It becomes that Tarmogoyf size.
Yeah, so maybe something worth revisiting that was Beastjiz's list. And I misspoke, it was not a 5-0, it was actually a 6-2 list from Modern Challenge. So perhaps an even more impressive finish, but we just haven't seen anything from this since then.
I tried. Couldn't get it published. Couldn't even come close to getting published. Couldn't even win two matches.
Yeah, so those were Modern, Standard. David, you tried a bunch of stuff in the Tempo space in Pioneer.
Oh yeah, I tried all kinds of stuff. So one of the things I thought would be interesting was a Mardu Vehicles list. I want to take advantage of the fact that like Heart of Kirin plus Gideon Blackblade was great against the like red-white Lurrus aggro decks, because you get to attack with this 4-4 lifelink, vigilance, heart, and then to kill it, they have to spend two removal spells, and then your Vaedrock, in theory, can bring it back, or bring back the Gideon Blackblade if they attack and kill that. The list was okay. Vaedrock is just super mana intensive. The red-red-white is not trivial to play. How much black do you want? And then, of course, you do the thing where you're hoping to play against all these red-white aggro decks, which I played with all my other lists that I brewed. I played it all the time. I never played that a single time. So that just gets frustrating when you're like, you know, ready for this one matchup and you're kind of giving away some percentage points in other matchups specifically to combat them, and then you never get to play them. I do think that Gideon interaction with Heart of Kirin is reasonably powerful, but again, you don't get to play a companion. I mean, that's one of the major costs of Vaedrock beyond just the mechanics of the card. The other thing that's kind of cool about it is the one drops have similar text like you and Damon were talking about. When you are on the 1-1 dwarf that gets +2/+1 if you have an artifact, now all of a sudden you get to attack for 5 if it's Vaedrocked. If you want to keep getting in there with Bomat Courier, you know, it gives Bomat Courier flying. So you can keep attacking. It's not as likely to have to sacrifice. The problem is that those 2-for-1 losses, again, are just, it's a huge tempo negative play. Like, okay, fine, you're getting in there with your Bomat Courier. When they kill it, you get to draw cards. But, I mean, you've already spent 5 mana plus the extra mana to sacrifice it. It's just, it's pretty mana intensive in a format that's pretty cutthroat at this point.
Yeah, that Gideon Heart of Kirin interaction is actually really strong. Basically, you play Heart of Kirin on 2, then on turn 3, you play Gideon. It's a creature already, so you can then uptick it, target Heart of Kirin, tap it to crew Heart of Kirin.
Yep.
Perhaps not in that order, I guess.
Yeah, right, but
swing for 4 with a lifelink, and then on defense, you can just take off a loyalty counter.
Yep.
Something to watch out for in the future.
Yeah, Gideon Blackblade specifically. I mean, the other Gideons also work pretty good with it, but Gideon Blackblade works great with it. One of the problems is, I think people had already realized in Pioneer, Lurrus is not the best thing to be doing. I think the Urion shells are. And I just could not get a fast enough clock. So, you know, eventually they set up their end game, whether it be the inverter kill or the sort of fires Urion, you know, bounce a bunch of enchantments that draw cards and exile your permanents, etc. So I do feel like there's something there. I'm not sure how many actual, like, Vaedrocks I would play if I wasn't trying to, like, brew around the card. I was playing 4 Vaedrocks. I would play way less, maybe 1. But, yeah, that shell is definitely something I've tooled around with. I've sent various shells to you guys over the months that Pioneers existed, and I think there's something there, probably.
Yeah, it reminds me a lot of when we tried Royal Scions out, and we had a very similar vehicle shell.
Yeah.
With the blue splash. So much for the tempo decks. Another thing that we talked about a good bit on the Rogue Refinery episode was token strategies. I talked about a standard build. I actually tried 2 builds in standard. One was more white-red Kahira tribal mixture. The other was closer to mono red, where I was trying to just make a ton of tokens with Forbidden Friendship and Raise the Alarm, and then I was getting my big payoff spells were things like Light Up the Stage, Skewer the Critics. And if you're wondering what happens with all those, why it didn't work, there's plenty of footage of me getting my shit pushed in, as David would say, with the Shadow of the Sky and Omen of the Sun, that kind of thing. It was very, very depressing matches. You also try this in Pioneer, David. Do you feel like there's anything there?
Again, I think Vaydrak was actually the worst card in the list, but Regal Liasaur is a sweet card. That really impressed me. You actually get a ton of 2-mana token makers, including the one that makes 2 artifacts to turn on your like Wild Nacatl effect in Pioneer. And so I would not be surprised if Urion decks were still in charge after the possible nerfing. This was a shell that I would just straight up race them. I'd even be Geiruda, just like killed them before they could cast their turn 4 Geiruda 2 out of 3 games.
Wow.
So like when you have that kind of clock or that the possibility for that kind of clock, that's something at least to pay attention to.
Yeah, and I do want to give a quick shout out to one of our listeners, Ill Sick Nasty, who is participating in our community league, and they had shared a really sweet Vaydrak tokens list that they're playing in week 1 of the league for Pioneer Week, and it's basically the Jeskai Ascendancy deck, the fair version, the tokens version, which was briefly sort of the final form of Ascendancy in Standard, using cards like Stoke the Flames, where you're getting paid off by having a wide board of tokens from like Whirling Outburst to just cast efficient spells, and then the Ascendancy is there to loot you and grow your team huge. So I think that's a really cool take on the deck, and I was happy to see just another attempt to explore the tokens angle.
Yeah, and one of the nice things about the looting of Ascendancy is it can pay you off by getting to, if you don't have time to cast some of your 3-mana spells earlier, then the Vaydrak can, you know, get them back. So you want to start looting as soon as possible so that Vaydrak can, you know, get back these high impact cards. Casting these 3-drops and then hoping that you get to cast a Vaydrak after the 3-drop goes to the graveyard is often too slow. But if you can like loot away something first and then get it back, then the Vaydrak trigger is like really paying you off for all the mana you're spending.
Yeah, one card that actually impressed me a little bit. I was watching Lawson's stream after a Rogue Refinery episode. He had some very interesting Mutate Brews. It was like a 80 card, 5 color Urion soup. But the card Cub Warden like seemed pretty good. I didn't have a good read on it, but like it just gets you a lot of stats on the board.
Yeah, Cub Warden, that mutates for 4. It's a 3/5 with lifelink, and it gives you 2/1/1 lifelink cats.
Right, every time you mutate.
I've tried this in my standard list, and I found that it was certainly better than Vaydrak every time I was trying to spend 4 mana to mutate in a tokens deck. Like, that was just better. And the Regal Liasaur, like you mentioned, David, was also more threatening. I did like how Vaydrak could rebuy Light Up the Stage and just get you further into the deck, but in terms of just board presence, I mean, Cub Warden is just a more reliable way to do that. That also has important ramifications for, like, these red matchups.
I mean, Cub Warden just making tokens is so important. Like, just you just need bodies to put stuff on, and the, like, extra Vaydrak triggers are often not worth not being able to add other bodies. So there were times when I, like, Vaydrak onto a Vaydrak, and then, okay, you get to double shock. But other times it would have been better to give like a different creature like flying or whatever so it could actually attack, because you're getting all these value chains, but you're not actually like winning the game. And so if you can't actually put a reasonable clock with these tempo shells, it doesn't matter how much mutate value you get. You're ultimately going to find yourself losing to, you know, 6 and 7 mana cards that go over the top of, you know, casting Light Up the Stage a couple times.
Yeah, these mutate triggers are really encourage you for going tall, because you have your first, you know, first base creature, then you cast a mutate trigger creature onto it, so you get 1 trigger. But now the next mutate trigger you mutate onto, you get 2 triggers, and then the next one after you get 3 triggers and 4 triggers and 5 triggers, and so it grows actually quadratically as you keep mutating onto it, and that's actually pretty busted. But the problem is that this is a, you know, all your resources in one basket, and so Cub Warden actually lets you go wide while you're also going tall, and that's a pretty cool effect to have.
Yeah, so much for the tokens angle. The last angle was maybe a combo strategy, and this question I want to pose to Damon specifically, because I watched you talk about your Chance for Glory deck on the show, and I still don't really understand what you were going for. What did you think was going to happen with Chance for Glory? And can you really just like walk us through like what was the end game? Were you trying to like loop it infinitely or something? Or
The objective here, I'm not going to claim this was coherent given it never worked out this way. But it involved having a Gideon of the Trials you play in turn 3, and then hopefully you keep Gideon alive somehow, and then you cast Chance for Glory with a Gideon emblem, and then you are basically casting a slightly more expensive Time Walk which is pretty, you know, Time Walk is busted if you have a Planeswalker on the board, any sort of board presence going on. And then if you have a Vaedrock out, you can ideally start chaining these turns together where, you know, maybe you just keep every turn you take, you can mutate again and just take enough turns to kill them with your 3-3 flying first strike plus a Gideon.
So it wasn't like a deterministic infinite chain. It was just like, I'm going to get a Time Walk and hopefully maybe get a couple more Time Walks if I draw more mutants.
Yeah, exactly. And it, actually, if you mutate onto a Dreadhorde Arcanist, that alone will let you cast it twice. So you cast it like the first time, and then you mutate on Dreadhorde Arcanist, you cast it again off Vaedrock's trigger, and then you attack, you cast it a third time. And if you can't win the game with three extra turns in this sort of tempo shell, like something's gone horribly wrong. I don't really know a way to like plan for infinite turns with Chance for Glory. It just doesn't really seem like what that card is built for. You already have to just plan to not lose is the key restriction here. I failed to meet that restriction several times.
All right, let me pose this question to David as well, because I think this was... you are to blame for this idea in the first place.
I have to take the blame.
Did you also try this in Pioneer? Or?
I did, yeah. It felt really bad. The problem, at the time, this is the list that I ended up having to play, like, freaking red-white Lurrus all the time. Is it's just so easy for them to kill Gideon. You know, you have to spend one of your turns zeroing Gideon, and you would prefer it to be the turn that Gideon comes down. If Gideon can come down on a clear board to zero, then the turn that you cast your extra turn, you get to attack with a 4-4. And then hopefully that next turn, you can assemble, you know, a creature plus Vaedrock to recast it. Then you finally get to untap with all your mana, and all you need to do is find a mutate creature to keep that going. That was another list that I was playing, like, 4 Gideon, 4 Teferi, and then 4 this Time Walk, just loading up on all these powerful 3-mana effects. The problem is, like, you can't ever even rebuy the 3-mana Time Walk without Gideon in play, and you don't have any of the other, like, redundant copies. Like, Damien played a couple other cards that prevent you from losing the turn. You're just stuck on 4 Gideon. Maybe you can play the 1 in a blue, like, counter-target legendary spell or triggered ability.
Tail's End, yeah.
Yeah, Tail's End. Maybe, like, one of those main deck is reasonable, especially in a world where it's, like, a lot of Lurrus and Urien. But you're just, like... If you draw 2 Time Walks and no Gideons, there's a bunch of times, much like Damon was describing, you just like, this is your last turn anyway, so might as well just like cast a Time Walk and like knock the top of your, like cast Opt and knock the top of your deck. You don't have any other options.
Chance of Glory is definitely an exciting magic card to play in your deck, even if it's not a very good one.
Absolutely.
Chances for Glory will be had. They may be missed. They will mostly be missed.
It's like liquidating your entire personal wealth and putting it on like 18 black.
Yeah.
You will be alive as that ball ricochets around the wheel there, but it's not a wise thing to be doing.
Yeah. I was actually not playing any of the other enablers for Chance for Glory. I didn't have room for them in the Vaedrock shell to play like Angel's Grace, much less the whole Madcap experiment plus Platinum Angel. That's the really cool one. That deck, I don't know why it disappeared. I mean, I'm sure it's not good enough, but that deck was awesome to watch. Madcap experiment into Platinum Angel, Pact of Negation, Chance for Glory. Get out of here.
Yeah, it's so weird that Chance for Glory grants Indestructible, and then that doesn't wear off.
Forever.
It just stays around for some reason, and people were like, is that a typo, or should they errata that? And then they just never did. So you will have a permanently indestructible creature.
Yeah. And so one of the things that was kind of interesting to me there was it's like a pseudo protection spell for your mutate, right? You're attacking, and like in your mind's eyes, like, all right, you cast this mutate creature onto Arcanist, and then they're like, well, I can't let Arcanist attack. And then they, you know, target it with some spell, and then you make your creature indestructible. But there's just so many moving parts, and you know, yeah, Modern has more tools. Pioneer, you know, you're competing against weaker decks, but you have less tools, so it's probably equally weak in both formats.
Yeah, the thing with Vaedrock is that it needs a lot of support, and so you just don't have a lot of room in your deck to make other things that need support work.
Yeah.
So the other combo angle that I thought was possible, and I think I saw someone in the queues in the Modern Leagues trying this, was using the card Metamorphose, which Damon ended up going pretty deep on in his Modern deck, but using it as a combo piece. So Vaedrock's mutate ability costs 4, but it can recast something worth up to 3. It could recast a ritual effect, for example. There are ways to get cheaper mutants, so you can have a Poliwag Symbiote into play that makes Vaedrock only cost 3 to mutate, and that makes your Sea Dasher Octopus only cost 1 to mutate. So in some universe, you can be mutating and getting multiple triggers off of Vaedrock while recasting Manamorphos or Desperate Ritual or something like that out of the graveyard. So I'm not sure if there's anything there. I mean, you'd have to play weird mutants that all mutate for two or less. Lore Dracus, Parcel Beast, Sea Dasher Octopus, Vaedrock. That's basically all you have to work with. I put together a sketch for this. I hesitate to even post it, but I tried it briefly. It was not really functional. But I guess I just wanted to ask you, Damon, sort of what do you think about the card Manamorphos in particular? Is that a good idea for Vaedrock, or is it just too weak of a payoff spell?
I would describe Manamorphos as excellent with Vaedrock in the sense that it is a somewhat weak payoff spell. It's certainly, you know, weaker than perhaps Teferi. But it is a card that you can slot into your deck and build a deck that's like a 56-card deck. And because of how it functions, it takes up no deck space. And so as a result, it just has a floor for your payoff and as you work towards ideally better things. And occasionally, Manamorphos will actually be incredibly good in the sense that, for example, when you're stacking multiple Vaedrock triggers, you actually need multiple pieces of fuel, because if they both target the same piece, the first one will actually reset the graveyard, and so the second trigger won't go through. And so you actually really want to have two spells in your graveyard, and so having a Manamorphos there will help you set that up. And secondly, when you play your Vaedrock, maybe what you do is you flashback Manamorphos and you use that to cast like the Lightning Helix stuck in your hand, and now you have two things in your graveyard ready to go for next turn. Or if you cast another Vaedrock next turn, you play two Manamorphoses, you'll draw cards to play with that mana. And so it just really functions quite well. It just cheapens the mana cost effectively on the turn you mutate and gives you a cantrip. Typically not as good as just casting like straight Lightning Helix, but sometimes it is actually about as good. And it goes nutty with Sea Dasher Octopus or any other 2CMC mutant, because you just can effectively mutate on infinitely as long as you keep having 2CMC mutates.
But what are you getting back from that? I mean, you lose the Sea Dasher Octopus and you just get back a draw?
Well, I mean, if you mutate onto a Vaedrock with three Sea Dasher Octopuses, you have this card that attacks and draws you three cards, which is Sea Dasher Octopus's purpose in life. It's not to make things 2/2.
All their tech stacks. I mean, you get as many draws as you have Sea Dasher Octopi.
Yeah, it's not for the stats. There are very few creatures upgraded by Sea Dasher Octopus.
So, like, going back to that Tribal Flame Zoo deck, do you think that Manamorphos would be a good inclusion in a deck like that?
That's an interesting one. That deck's mana base could certainly use a little bit of Manamorphosing. In that deck, you have enough burn spells that that probably just sets your baseline. What's interesting is you could also, you know, you can rebuy Mishra's Bauble as another cheap spell. I think Manamorphos is, like, a little bit better, but it's an interesting question, Dan.
That's just so depressing. That's so depressing to rebuy a bubble when the Lurus decks could do it for free.
Yeah.
I guess my feeling, just like hearing some of your tales of woe, you did go 4-1 in your first league, but after that it didn't sound too good.
The wheels fell off. I went insane.
Was that like rebuying a spell that isn't really worth that much mana just wasn't enough of a payoff? Like, I was happy when I was getting Teferi because that's like worth more than 3 mana. It only cost 3 mana because they were very generous, but it's like a really powerful effect. And every time I mutated Vaedrock, I felt like I was just like getting away with something. Huge turn. And if I was just getting a cantrip and 2 mana back, I wouldn't really feel as excited about that. As certainly with Mishra's Bauble, just drawing a card is not worth the mutate trigger to me.
Yeah. I think that just generally with Vaedrock, the first trigger really almost ever is really worth it. What really pulls you ahead is the second trigger. It really does do this quadratic growth as you get subsequent Vaedrocks onto it.
All right, so if you want some really cool gameplay footage, I think especially Dan sort of had the most successful deck, so there's lots of cool footage and sort of lots of cool theory crafting between all three of us and the two hosts, so check out Rogue Refinery Episode 3. That's on YouTube now. What are our sort of closing thoughts on Vaedrock? I'll go first. I just think the card is already questionably powered in terms of Pioneer's generic power level and is very poorly positioned because all the hate for Lurrus basically hits Vaedrock. So I found the card very frustrating to play with. It seems like it has a lot of potential and all those ways you can use it are just a little below rate in every direction, mana, power, etc. for Pioneer.
So I think that the reason I was excited about Vaedrock was because it's part of like a premier cycle of mythics and it was the cheapest member of that cycle, the Apex Predator cycle. It seemed to have a trigger that lets you cheat on mana somewhat, so I was like, oh, this is probably the best of the cycle. But having played with it now, I'm left with, I think, what Damon's conclusion was, that first trigger just isn't worth enough. So when you have to actually trigger it multiple times, which I was able to do, like, that was okay, but it also just, like, wasn't the payoff that I thought it might be, and makes me wonder if, like, we should have picked Nethroy or something with, like, a more game-winning mutate trigger as our exploration of the mutate cycle.
Yeah, the fundamental problem with Vaadrok is that mutate is in this form what's called a parasitic mechanic, namely you need other mutate cards to really make it work. And honestly, I don't think we're going to be seeing too many mutate cards in the future. I think it's just a kind of strange mechanic ultimately, like the non-human thing is just strange. So like if you had some sort of like Snapcaster mutate or like a Bogle with mutate, then maybe you'd start having like the critical mass you need to make Vaadrok worth it, but as is, it's just too tricky. The juice is not worth the squeeze, as David says.
Absolutely. So people check out Rogue Refinery Episode 3. We kind of go do a deep dive in all three formats there. And we want to do a quick shout out to Episode 4. It should be out by the time this episode is out. We go deep on Fiend Artisan. I especially had a super sweet deck. I won't tell any tales right now. I got a lot of messages from these guys and the two hosts about like, what is your deck doing? Like, what's happening here? Explain these card choices. So it's laid out in a really cool way. They kind of break down at least the like level one default, some of the cool chains you can find. But I actually was really impressed with the deck that Dan found, and Damon had some sweet success with his number one card. It's an 0/3 for one green mana. Spoiler alert, Fiend Artisan can turn that into something else after it ramps you. So yeah, that's out now. It's a little shorter episode because of the holiday, but I was very impressed with how the episode turned out. So I think that's definitely worth checking out.
Yeah, for sure. Great episode. That was a lot of fun. And you can find that on the main Magic the Gathering YouTube channel. So just go to, I don't know how to get there. Go to our Twitter at FaithlessMTG. We've linked it there. Or go to YouTube, just type in Rogue Refinery. You'll find the episodes that way.
And then a little spoiler for next week. We have been tasked with brewing around the new 5-mana Vivian from Ikoria. So that's a card Dan's had his eye on for a while. He's pretty excited. And we've been already experimenting with some great deal of success, I have to say. So it's been kind of a fun card. It's been pretty rewarding to tool around with a lot of the different things you can do with it.
Yeah, if you are a monster and you get put in jail for some unwarranted reason, Vivian is your advocate.
I will just add that I'm playing standard with Vivian, Monsters Advocate, and I'm having a tough go of it so far. So if anyone out there has a cool Vivian list, send it my way. The problem I'm finding is that it's not a mana engine. It's a payoff for your mana, but it invites you to spend a lot of mana on other effects. It's hard to do that when that's the same turn they're stealing all your stuff with Agent of Treachery. Weirdly enough, it's a better card in Modern and Pioneer, at least based on our early results so far.
Yeah, I think I broke it in Modern, so send your help Dan's way. I'm good. I'm being slightly hyperbolic here.
I believe it. All right, so I think that'll do it for this edition of Faith is Brewing.
Yeah, so see you guys in the queues, and maybe before our next episode, the queues will be free of companions. It'll be a 1v1 match, no interference.
Take care.
Deuces.
That'll do it for this edition of the Faith is Brewing podcast. You can find the deck lists from today's show at faithlessbrewing.podbean.com or in the episode description in your podcast player. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at faithlessmtg. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please be so kind as to leave us a rating and review. Faith is Brewing is a listener-supported show. We rely on brewers like you to help us improve the show and bring you better content. So if you like what you heard and would like to lend us your support, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/faithlessbrewing. All patrons get access to our Discord channel and other cool rewards, but more important than that, the contributions of our supporters are what allow this show to get made. So thank you again to all of our patrons and all of our listeners. We look forward to hearing from you, and we will see you next week.